You ever wonder what your life would be like if you never met your wife?
Wonder if I'd be better off without her?
No. I'm not saying like better off. I didn't mean it like.
It's all right. It's an important question. Because you'll have bad times, but that'll always wake you up to the good stuff you weren't paying attention to.
And you don't regret meeting your wife?
Why? Because the pain I feel now? Oh, I got regrets, Will, but I don't regret a single day I spent with her.
So when did you know, like, that she was the one for you?
October 21st, 1975.
Jesus Christ, you know the fucking day?
Oh, yeah. Because it was game 6 of the World Series. Biggest game in Red Sox history?
Yeah, sure.
My friends and I had slept out on the sidewalk all night to get tickets.
You got tickets?
Yep. Day of the game, we're sitting in a bar waiting for the game to start, and in walks this girl. It was an amazing game, though. You know, bottom of the 8th, Carbo tied it up. It was 6-6. It went to 12. Bottom of the 12th, in stepped Carlton Fisk.
Old Pudge. Steps up to the plate, you know, he's got that weird stance.
Yeah.
And then, boom! He clocks it, you know. High fly ball on the left field line. 35,000 people on their feet, yelling at the ball, but that's not because Fisk, he's waving at the ball like a madman.
Yeah,
he's going, get over! Get over! Get over! And then it hits a foul pole. Oh, he goes apeshit, and 35,000 fans, you know, they charge the field, you know?
Yeah, and he's fucking blowing
up. He's like, go, get on there. Get away!
I can't fucking believe you had tickets to that fucking game!
Yeah.
Did you rush the field?
No, I didn't rush the fucking field. I wasn't there.
What?
No, I was in a bar having a drink with my future wife.
You missed Pudge Fisk's home run?
Oh, yeah.
To have a fucking drink with some lady you never met?
Yeah, but you should have seen her. She was a stunner.
I don't care if
No, she lit up the room.
I don't care if Helena Troy walks into the room. That's game 6.
Oh, my God. And who are these fucking friends of yours? They let you get away with that?
They had to.
What did you say to them?
I just slid my ticket across the table and I said, sorry, guys, I gotta see about a girl.
I gotta go see about a girl?
Yeah.
That's what you said?
I had.
And they let you get away with that?
Oh, yeah, they saw in my eyes that I meant it.
You're kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding you, Will. That's why I'm not talking right now about some girl I saw at a bar 20 years ago and how I always regretted not going over and talking to her. I don't regret the 18 years I was married to Nancy. I don't regret the 6 years I had to give up counseling when she got sick. And I don't regret the last years when she got really sick. I don't regret missing a damn game. That's regret.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me today is senior editor Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
And associate editor Perry Nemiroff.
Hi.
Today we will be talking about Robin Williams. His sad passing last Monday really took everyone for surprise. And there's something I feel I should make clear to our listeners. The 100th episode of The Collision was posted on Tuesday, and some were confused about why we would talk about that and the topic of that show as opposed to talking about Robin Williams. We actually recorded that episode on Sunday, but it wasn't posted until Tuesday due to technical reasons. So it's not that we ignored it or forgot about it. It's just the way the timing happened, because we do want to talk about it. He left a great impact on so many lives. And I know for the three of us, he hit a phase in his career when he went to more family fare. And this is when we were younger. So stuff like Aladdin, Mrs. Doubtfire, Hook, films really directed at a family audience, and then just sort of growing into seeing his other films. So we sort of, he got us while we were young. He was like a kid. That's how you do it. You got to hook them while they're kids. And then you, or at least I did, I wasn't aware at the time, like, oh, he did stand-up comedy, and I didn't even know Mork and Mindy was a spinoff of Happy Days. I just watched it on Nick at Night. And just seeing this funny guy, and then the more you saw of him, the more versatility you realized he had. And that was one of the such of the rewarding things about his career, is that not all of his films were great. You work in Hollywood long enough and you are going to have your share of flops. But he also had more than his fair share of great films and great performances. And he kept managing to surprise us, especially for me, and I'm going to let you guys talk in just one moment, but the transition he'd made into the 2000s where he decided to take a much darker turn in his role choice. So he was just someone that I always felt was worth paying attention to, even if I wasn't going to go see Old Dogs or RV. It was never like trying to say, and Robin Williams is done with acting, you know, just I've lost all interest in what he has to do, because you always just hope he could always still surprise you.
Yeah, he was, I mean, my kind of introduction to him was in the early 90s with, you know, it was the 1-2 punch of Mrs. Doubtfire and Hook and then Jumanji. And I think it was Kitty Rich who pointed out on Twitter, she said, did anyone else feel like he was a surrogate father figure? And for me, like my parents divorced when I was 5 and my dad wasn't around much. So I think that's why this one hit particularly close to home, because when I was younger and being introduced to Robin Williams films, he was playing the father figure in these movies, and more often than not, the absent father figure. And so that was kind of my introduction to him. And I was kind of surprised by how much his death shook me. Like I couldn't even bring myself to watch anything of his afterwards. I was really upset about it. And you know, everyone was like, oh, you know, tonight I'm going to watch Mrs. Doubtfire or whatever in his honor. And I couldn't bring myself to do it. I just rewatched The Fisher King a couple days ago, and that was kind of hard for me. But yeah, I was really surprised by how much it shook me. And it's been rough. It's been a rough week.
Yeah. In more ways than one.
Yeah,
yes.
But that combined with Ferguson, it's been a terrible, terrible week.
We really needed that dancing Groot. We really needed it in the worst way. Just that small solace. Yes, it was a horrible week. Perry, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm definitely in the same boat as you guys. You know, having grown up in the early 90s and just in time for Mrs. Doubtfire, Aladdin, Jumanji, and I had an obsession with Hook for quite some time. I was telling some friends the other day, when I was a little kid, my grandparents for Hanukkah, they bought me one of those TVs with the VCR built into it, which was like the coolest thing ever at the time. And I actually still own that same TV now. But I went through a phase when I was a kid where I wouldn't go to sleep without the TV on. I would put the TV on and leave the timer on. And I'd basically have a VHS tape that would sit in the player. And I would watch the same movie over and over, I mean, for like months at a time, and never take it out. And in that rotation, I very much remember Mrs. Doubtfire, Jumanji, but not Hook, because Hook actually used to scare me. As someone who loves horror movies now, that scene where he comes home and like the kids are gone and poor Maggie Smith is just like huddled in a corner, that always flipped me out. But
John Williams' crazy score that just keep going up and down and up and down.
I'll never forget that scene. I've seen people like rip limb from limb now, but that's always the one that sticks with me when I like go to my parents' house and it's dark.
It's always those films that when you're kids, it's like the, now you're an adult, like, yeah, there's horror and there's disturbing stuff, but it's like the old Disney movies, even like the witch turning into in Snow White, the queen turning into the old hag. It's just, there's creepy shit in there. But yeah, Hook is definitely
just the lady. The children were screaming.
Yeah, that's such a weird film because Spielberg hates it. It wasn't even his.
And I'm glad you brought that up, Perry, because this Hook is a movie that I can recognize as not a good movie, but I was obsessed with it as a kid. I listened to the soundtrack on repeat. I had the Rufio sword. Like it was one of those that, you know, I see as not a very good film now, but something about it just connected to people our age, I think of our generation, and it was just kind of a mesmerizing movie. And a lot of that was Robin Williams as kind of the absent father figure that is kind of trying to do good, and he's just so likable, even though he's not a likable character. You know, it's the 90s, so he's got the big black cell phone and always business.
But it's such a perfect role for Williams as well, because it's not just, he wasn't just the father figure, he also was the inner child.
Yeah.
And that was repeatedly seen. So the fact that he's playing an old Peter Pan is so perfect to who he was defining himself as a character. And you can even see that in a much darker sense in Toys, which is such a weird
movie. That's the weirdest movie.
It really is. But yeah, you sort of see that there. And again, Mrs. Doubtfire, father figure, but there's a guy dressing up as a woman. And I love that scene, though, where he's basically discouraging trying to make other applicants look bad, made up applicants by just doing different voices, like just playing into all these personas, but with a childlike glee. Like you're coming up with almost imaginary friends, almost, as you just cut to one and the other and the other, and just that clownishness, but without the condescension of it, rather just having a free form fun. And you can see that improvisation with him in so many things, especially his stand-up, but even just his regular roles, where it was clear that the director was giving him space to try things out.
That's part of the reason, to me, his movies are so special still today. Like you were saying before, that Hook isn't even that great of a movie, and I mean, I do recognize it. I guess this doesn't really fit in well with Hook, but with his comedy in particular, part of the reason that I still love it and it still touches me to this day is because it was never just played for jokes. There was always an awareness of the real situation at hand, like Mrs. Doubtfire. He never kind of brushed over the fact that he was a man dressing up as a woman, and a lot of things like that end up sticking with you because they have that extra layer to it versus, let's say, you know, like Adam Sandler. You know, some of those movies I still love to death, but it doesn't hit you the same way. It's like you laugh at the joke and that's it. Robin Williams movies, that sticks with you.
Yeah, I don't... For Robin Williams, I felt... You bring up Adam Sandler, and I can't help but wonder if today's younger generation, like, they'll really connect with him. But with Robin Williams, I feel like there's more for the audience, where an Adam Sandler film is clearly, like, me and my buddies want to go make a movie and someone will pay us to do it.
But I almost thought about throwing Jim Carrey into the equation, too. But he's, like, borderline. He's, like, half Robin Williams, half Adam Sandler. Like, I was even thinking about Liar, Liar. And, you know, even that, it really recognizes what the heart of the movie is. And it kind of plays with it, but it still respects the reality of it.
I think the key is their willingness to kind of bare their soul. If you watch an Adam Sandler movie and he tries to get serious, it almost seems like he's a little bashful or embarrassed to be, you know, going so serious, and so he doesn't. But in, you know, Robin Williams and Jim Carrey, when they have those kind of touching, you know, heart-to-heart moments and comedies as goofy as Mrs. Doubtfire, you can see that they're bearing a part of themselves. It's very genuine and honest, and they're not afraid to go to a sentimental place because it comes from a place of honesty.
Yeah, I mean, with Carrey is just, I mean, his father died right before he got successful. And so you're right, Adam, there's absolutely this something that they're pulling, something that came from within. There is this, I'm going to share something with you. And when I share something with you, there's going to be something honest there. And I think it really helped Robin Williams in more ways than one, in the sense of he could have a film like Dead Poets Society, which is so earnest. That film just wears its heart on its sleeve. And it's a Peter Weir film, no less, which is not, he's not the guy you think would go for that. But that film is something that is uplifting and inspirational. And I think, again, in terms of Williams blending the father figure with someone who can appeal to younger folks, that character is so much, I'm a leader, but he's so young. He's such a young teacher that you can understand why those students would identify with him.
It's like the same thing with Mrs. Doubtfire, too, being able to identify with him as a kid. And that was kind of like one of the first movies of its time to deal with divorce, too. So I guess, I mean, it's like what you were saying before, Adam. You know, you see, if you're at that age, you see someone acting like that, and it's impossible not to look up to him and kind of respect him for how he's dealing with it and have him teach you a little something about it for that reason.
Yeah, and right. When I was younger, the two actors that were like my role models, the first two that I ever became kind of obsessed with and were my entry points to kind of being falling in love with movies, were Robin Williams and Harrison Ford. And I still remember making my mom take me to go see 6 Days, 7 Nights because Harrison Ford's in it, so it has to be good. But I remember that feeling of you know, after you've seen Mrs. Doubtfire, after you've seen Hook and Aladdin, I would go to Blockbuster and I'd be like, all right, what are the other Robin Williams movies? And I was a little younger, but I was delving into stuff like Awakenings and Good Morning Vietnam, stuff that was a little rougher around the edges, that I was kind of blown away by his range in those kinds of movies, because I had only known him from Mrs. Doubtfire. And I really liked Toys for some reason, even though that's just a dark, weird movie.
Yeah,
I really
Toys
liked
used to
that
freak
one.
Me out.
It's so weird. I still don't really understand it. But he was able to bring something to each of those roles, even when he was serious or a little darker. That
it
was...
makes you want his characters to be part of your life. It's like in Dead Poets Society, you want him to be your teacher. In Mrs. Doubtfire, you want him to be your nanny. And it can carry over into a lot of his other movies, too. It, you know, it's like what you said with Harrison Ford, too. It's like I watch Air Force One, and I'm like, I wish Harrison Ford was our president.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I too wish he punched more people off of planes. That's what Obama's lacking. Just doesn't punch enough Russians off of planes.
Yeah.
But the thing about Williams, and I'm in total agreement with what you guys are saying, is especially Adam in terms of being an entry point. I think Robin Williams was the first actor I was a fan of. Because it was just, just watching him on Nick at Night, and then that Aladdin, Hook, Mrs. Doubtfire, that sort of trifecta, if you will. Not in terms of, these are the best movies ever, but just as a kid, you're like, I am recognizing who this personality is. And his movies are making me feel joy. And so I want to see more of what he does. And then, of course, you go to Awakenings, and it's surprising, and... again, looking over his filmography, is that even though there were phases of hits like Mrs. Doubtfire and Aladdin, he never really left doing other kind of roles. He didn't just be like, and now it's family films from here on out. Like, he was still doing Awakenings and other films that would challenge him. It seemed like he...
Jack.
And Jack, which is another weird... film.
Francis Ford Coppola saying, I'm out of money. Give me a job, please.
Right. And here's the thing about it's interesting you bring up Jack, because even some of his flops were so memorable that other people felt the need to keep referencing them.
They're endearing.
So, like,
I mean, it's,
they're
again,
endearing.
It's not a great movie, but it's Robin Williams that makes it a worthwhile endeavor, or something at least admirable.
I think it's because he's memorable that he... the high concept of it is sort of kept alive. So the notion of Jack disease, which we just call it now when, like, an overgrown child, you know, oh, exactly. Or we talk about and even though Mrs. Doubtfire, I think, I haven't seen it in forever, but I remember liking it. But of course, when Tobias dresses up as a woman in Arrested Development, you have that great scene. And then Children's Hospital, is Rob Corddry's character, is entirely a parody of Patch Adams, and what a ridiculous film that is. And so, yeah, even though not all of these films are great, they're memorable. And yet, Robin Williams is never really brought down by them. I don't know. I'm feeling like...
Can you even think of one bad performance?
One bad performance?
I can't really think about any single role that, you know, like, he didn't do his best at.
Yeah, that he wasn't, like, even movies that are less memorable, like Bicentennial Man or Father's Day or Flubber. He's still funny.
Hey, Flubber was fun.
Flubber was fun. I enjoyed it.
I disagree with you both on that one.
Didn't like Flubber.
I didn't like, even though as a kid, I did not like Flubber because I liked The Absent-Minded Professor.
Yeah.
I liked the original.
Yeah.
But the thing about Williams, I agree, Barry, is that he never felt like he was phoning it in.
Yeah.
He was always giving you 110%, even though, and then I'll be honest, there were some films I was just, I've never seen Old Dogs, never gonna see Old Dogs.
Yeah.
I may have seen RV
in passing
one
time. You know, RV is more fun than you would think it would be. I mean, it's a pretty typical commercial comedy, but, you know, it's like one of those things where if it comes on and I'm just sitting on the couch and the remote control is too far away, I don't mind leaving it on.
I saw License to Wed, and that's one of those things where it's not a good movie, but Robin Williams pops up, and you're like, well, this makes it a little more entertaining, because he's always so bright and joyful, and I think that's one of the reasons that this hurts so bad, to see that someone was in such pain, that was always so giving and so joyful and so, you know, he brought so much happiness to everyone, to see that there was this inner turmoil going on.
Yeah, that is one of the things where it's sort of... And nothing makes it... The weird thing is, like, nothing can make it better, because you lost someone that was so endearing and that you thought you'd have for longer, for sure. Absolutely that. And I almost to the point where I feel like I was taking him for granted. Like, ah, I'm not going to watch the crazy ones. Sure, it's Robin Williams on a weekly basis, but I'm just not interested.
It makes me really regret not covering. I got an opportunity to cover, I think, The Angriest Man in Brooklyn. What was it, last year? And I just never got around to it.
No,
now I feel terrible that I didn't.
Right. No, I was reading other people who would, like, I interviewed Robin Williams one time, and it's just like, man, I'll never get that chance. I would love to have just talked with, or just to thank him in person for just all that joy.
I bumped into him in the street once. That was it. Just walked right past him. I looked at him. I'm like, you're my childhood right there.
Yeah. That's the thing. And so it is so sad that he was suffering so much, and that it plays against it. Like, if it had just been like some medical ailment that, like, no one can predict, like a heart attack, it's like, you know, it's very sad, but it's like, it's a heart attack. It's like, you know, it happens. Like, but this is this dichotomy makes it hurt so much. And then you realize, and then there was the revelations that he had early onset of Parkinson's, and you're just like, come on. He brought happiness to so many people. And yes, you just like, oh, life is an unfair and horrible place, but you go and watch some of his movies and they make you feel better, or at the very least they make you think. Even the ones that aren't totally uplifting, you can still be drawn into them and think about things. So 1 hour photo, super dark but really good. And quite honestly, the fact that first off, Williams kind of playing, like, that was one of his first roles where he's really playing against type in a big way. And the fact that he teamed up with Mark Romanek on Romanek's debut feature, it's one of those reasons I think that, even though we're now starting to make fun of Mark Romanek for joining projects he will inevitably leave, you watch 1 hour photo and you don't want him to leave those projects, because that was such a good film and Williams was such a large part of why that's a good film. He is, it's just a great melding of director and star, where you don't really know what to expect from either of them, even though you are aware of their past work, but seeing that alchemy of it. And that's what Williams could do, because even though you may have thought you had him pegged, he could still do exciting things.
Yeah, that was 2002. That was his three films in 2002 were Insomnia, Death to Smoochie, and 1 hour photo, which was just a complete 180, and you could tell he was getting into something different.
And it was almost sort of like a, I mean, when you say a 180, if you look at what he was doing just before that, it was more on the films where he was starting to get written off as saccharine. So Bicentennial Man, What Dreams May Come, Jacob the Liar, films where he was starting to, and that was immediately following Good Will Hunting, which is one of his best performances.
Yeah.
So I think he was very aware of where his career was, but I think also maybe just in terms of, I want to do something different. So, and I think it speaks to his talent that when given an option, you have these films, these sort of more schmaltzy films that aren't really working. So what do you do? Well, you could go back to the early 90s kids films where you were hugely successful, or what does he do instead? He's like, I'm going to do something entirely different that will probably be more creatively fulfilling. It may not always work, but it's something that audiences aren't expecting, and I can do something new.
That makes me think back to Adam Sandler again, because, like, I grew up with both of them, and, like, one is still making me happy to this day, and the other is frustrating me to no end because he didn't make that decision. It's like he tried to do different things, and it didn't pan out, so he's just like, all right, what the hell? I'll try to recreate it and make some money that way. Well, obviously, I can't really speak for him, but that's kind of how I feel, versus Robin Williams, whose stuff can still play over and over. And, you know, he took some risks later on in his career, and some of them did pay off. You know, one thing that people tend to knock that I think deserves a little more credit is August Rush, because he's got a really interesting role in that. That movie's a little schmaltzy every now and then, but his character is kind of fascinating, because, like, at first you think he's, you know, Freddie Highmore, his character, his savior, and he feels like the safety net, and then all of a sudden does a little turn and he gets kind of creepy.
That is one I missed. I have not seen August Rush.
Right, me too. And that's, again, now I'm feeling, first off, there are films on the later side of his career where, again, it felt like these are films where it's almost a hodgepodge. So you're going to have films like the final cut, but you're also going to have mixed in with Night at the Museum. So you're going back to the, you know, so you have this still, like, he's doing more these weird things. August Rush is sort of an indie drama, but it's right next to License to Wed. And so you're going on, and it's just sort of, what is he up to now? There, it's not really phases as much as he's just doing different things. And yet, I know on the other side of his career, you know, like we're saying, we came in more in the early 90s. So I have never seen Popeye, which has a cult following despite its reputation as a really disaster of a production. And people like his performance. And I can't really speak to Popeye because I've never seen it. But it's one of those things where I'm still curious and want to. And yet there are other performances of his that I would prefer to revisit, which I know doesn't speak well of me as a film fan. But given the choice, I'd rather rewatch The Fisher King than see Popeye.
I only watched Good Morning Vietnam for the first time a couple, like, weeks ago even.
That's a tremendous performance of his.
It's fantastic. And then, you know, I go online and I'm starting to read about how they did it. The fact that he can improvise like that on set is just astounding.
That's one of the fascinating things about him as a comedian, is because he had that strange crossover where all stand-up comedians need to be able to improvise to some extent. You get a heckler, you get, you know, you try out things. But Williams almost had this free association where he would just go and go and go. And this part of that sort of firecracker unpredictability that gave this energy to all of his performance, that there was an unpredictability there, and yet you always knew it was controlled. So yeah, it was almost, you know, I don't know what he's going to do next, but I trust that he's in control of it.
It just totally blows my mind when it takes me so long to write, you know, like 500 words, and he's just coming up with these completely different ideas, like at this rapid fire pace. I can't comprehend how so many ideas can come into one person's head like that.
Yeah, you even saw him. He was one of the best late night talk show guests because he was always so quick and always on. And I remember him coming on Conan when Conan was kind of in that in-between stage on The Tonight Show where, like, NBC wasn't talking to him anymore, but he was reading in the press that he was going to be fired. And so he was like, well, we're going to do our show, whatever we're going to do. And Williams came on, and Williams was just great at kind of picking up on that and riffing on the fact that Conan, everyone knew Conan's days were numbered, and they were just kind of sitting there waiting for the hammer to come down.
Did you read that story that Norm MacDonald posted about Robin Williams when they were on Letterman together? I mean, that's kind of another example of how he just comes up with, like, an idea out of the blue, and look how he touched this guy's life, and I'll never forget that.
Right, and that's one of the things in the wake of his death, just all these public outpourings and eulogizing, and you start to see a picture of the guy behind the scenes that becomes very clear, because it's not just one person saying it. When you just read comedian after comedian after comedian saying he came on and just wanted to meet and help out and wasn't trying to upstage anyone, even young comedians, he was just sort of there as a helpful, giving presence to never forget people who weren't as famous as he was, but he still cared. He was he was incredibly supportive. That's a word I'm seeing come up a lot, is supportive. And I don't know, I just find that very, it's just yet another thing. I didn't know he was a gamer. That was another big revelation.
He loved Warcraft, which I find really endearing.
He named his daughter after The Legend of
Zelda. Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah,
I think his son is named after another character too, but it's unspecified or something like that.
It's just there's great little more things, and again, it makes me so upset because again, it's something again I took this guy for granted almost. He was so left such an impact, and yet I'll be perfectly honest, he has 4 films that have left to come out, and I had seen the trailer for Angriest Man in Brooklyn, but it wasn't like, and now I will go see that. It wasn't, I was a fan of his, and yet he wasn't drawing me out like other actors, not because I had necessarily written him off, but I think it is because I took him for granted. It's like, he'll just keep, you know, maybe there will be, I know he has more better stuff ahead of him, and I'll catch those movies.
Yeah.
And that's, that just makes me so
angry. Or it's kind of like, oh,
angry.
He'll pop up as Dwight Eisenhower and the butler, and that'll be fun. You know, that's what he'll do. He'll pop up and then right. You know, liven up some of these movies that are otherwise kind of boring or not as good.
Yeah. He'll be a nice presence for the 5 minutes he's on screen in A Night at the Museum film.
Yeah.
You know, he'll have some good one-liners, say something inspirational to Ben Stiller, and we'll move on.
That's just the worst feeling with something that's supposed to be a happy family friendly movie, and you know, we're not going to be able to go into that one without this kind of affecting that movie's release. It ends up being so hard to talk about this stuff.
Well, I think it's hard to talk about anything now when anything that references death. I mean, rewatching The Fisher King, a friend of mine mentioned an episode of Louis from season 3 that I hadn't seen.
Oh, but that episode of Louis is, like, in retrospect. And you look at it and you start to see this kind of pattern of him just knocking these really dark, kind of tortured roles out of the park. And you see, like, an inner turmoil dealing with, not necessarily mental illness, but just a darkness that, you know, you see someone... Again, taking him for granted. We see him in Mrs. Doubtfire. He's always on. He's always happy. You just assume this guy is always happy. But when you look back over it and you look what he's able to do with roles in like Good Will Hunting and The Fisher King especially, that one is just terrifying. And Dead Poets Society, these roles that have this tinge of darkness to the characters that make them so interesting. And he does such a fantastic job at them. And you look back over him and you can see kind of – and I think that – If you follow along comedy at all, you know that kind of some of the comedy greats, most comedy greats are not the most happy of people, and they'll be upfront with that. And it's just kind of
especially in stand-up comedy.
Yeah,
especially stand-up.
Yeah, I was reading a few quotes from him recently because there's just so many articles and so many things about him right now, and some of them said, you know, when you are under the pressure to get up and perform so constantly like that, you kind of have no choice but to turn to certain substances to kind of keep it up, and the pressure, I can understand it, the pressure must just eat away at you.
Absolutely. And I think, Adam, going back to something you said in terms of the roles he chose, you got me thinking about how many times he played caretakers, people who looked after sick people. So you have Patch Adams, you have Good Will Hunting and Awakenings, which are two characters that look after people with Awakenings isn't mental, it's more of a physiological problem, but people who have something where there's the right personality, he's trying to bring out a healthy personality.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a level of sympathy there that can't be faked. You really do get a sense of someone who would deeply care for other characters.
Or that's even like in Aladdin too.
Right. And I haven't seen what Dreams May Come.
Oh,
that's...
man.
It was actually just on TV before we hopped on this call. I watched the very last scene, and that was it.
Ugh. I can't even imagine going back to that one now.
Yeah, I don't think I ever want to watch the whole thing.
No.
That's the thing. It's just like, even I rewatched The Birdcage, and there's a line where he's like, I think he's like, I'll kill myself. Like, just, but it's like an offhand comedic line, and I heard, and I just like cringed.
Well,
or maybe it was...
You guys listened? Did either of you listen to him on Mark Maron's podcast in 2010, his WTF podcast?
I did not.
No,
hear that.
I mean I saw the links to it, but I didn't get around to listening to it.
It's a fantastic podcast, and he's very honest and very open about you know, he was an alcoholic, and very honest about how, you know, he lapsed and broke his sobriety. But towards the end of the podcast, he starts into a bit that's not really a bit, but it's essentially his conscience talking to himself, and he's describing a time when it was really dark, the time that he decided to get sober for the second time. I guess he broke his sobriety in the mid-2000s or late-2000s, so and he's talking to himself with his conscience, and he's talking to him like, do you really think you have the guts to do that? Like, do you think you can kill yourself? And no. Do you think that the bottle of Jack Daniels in your hand is one of the reasons? Well, maybe, yeah. And it's meant to be funny, and that, like, his conscience is telling him that, you know, there's no way you could do that. There's no way you could harm yourself. But listening to it in retrospect is just heartbreaking, because he's essentially recounting an experience in his life when he was contemplating suicide.
Right. And that's sort of the thing about all I can't help but wonder what it will be like rewatching old, like, how will I view Aladdin again? And I think honestly, I think the happiness will shine through, but there will always be, if something comes close to it, to suicide, to death, it will start sort of having a heavier meaning than it did than it would have otherwise.
It doesn't even need to have a direct connection to that. I mean, even going back to, you know, like Philip Seymour Hoffman, Heath Ledger, like the second something like this happens to someone, there's no watching their work again without disassociating from what happened eventually. I mean, there's still fun in it. I watched Mrs. Doubtfire the other day and I still thoroughly enjoyed it, but you know, I'm sitting there and watching it and I'm looking at him and I'm just like shit, like this is it. This is what we have from him, and now we can't have anything else.
Right. But I do feel like the manner of death changes things. I really do, because I can watch Peter O'Toole has died. I can watch Lawrence of Arabia unaffected. It's just unaffected. It's a great performance. And his death just was part of, that's the long career we want for these actors. I want this long career for Heath Ledger. I want this long career for Philip Seymour Hoffman. I want this long career for Robin Williams, where it's just, give me, just give us a full body of work, and we don't get it, and we lose it because of these circumstances. And it's just, I think it's the tragedy of life being cut short, but especially in the circumstances of drugs and suicide, and just that giving it this heavier, more painful thing, because when those things happen, it's that realization that this person who brings joy to so many others can't take any for themselves. And it's just so frustrating, because you want them to have what they shared with us.
It's like a weird mix of selfishly being like, I can't have any more of what I like, and also like I just feel for them, you know? We see them up on a screen and you never really know what life is like behind closed doors, and it's not fair that that's how they're feeling when they're making everybody else feel so great.
Yeah, and I will say, though, I think one of these things, and the word like is such a weird one to use, but that when these things happen, that there are those who can sort of feel that it brings attention to something. So when Philip Seymour Hoffman died, it brought attention to drug addiction. And now when Robin Williams died, it brings attention to depression. And helping people understand, to just do something. It's like almost like you're still giving us something, even, you know, because we still want more from you. And it's not like, you know, it's not a silver lining, but it's something where I'm glad that people can understand, at least that this outpouring of sympathy also includes something that we should understand, something that we should understand, that depression is a disease, and that Robin Williams, who's beloved by millions of people the world over, can't feel that. That's a disease. That's depression in the way. And I hope that people can understand that. And I think some people do understand that now in a way that they may not have before.
Oh, that is a good point. You know, when you look at someone like that and you think they've got like the whole world in the palm of their hands, it kind of puts your own issues into perspective a little bit.
Right. And so I just, there is no good here, other than you go back and you watch these performances and they're still uplifting, but now they're also heartbreaking. And I think in time that will heal in some respects. I think you go back and it'll be a little easier a few years from now to maybe watch The Fisher King than it is now, but it's still, that's the thing, it's still fresh and it's still painful. And yet I had never seen that Louis episode, and someone on my Twitter feed was like, I know I can't watch it again, it'll wreck me. And I'm like, I want to see this, because I feel like I don't want to avoid this. I want to not run from his work. I want to see these things, even if they are painful.
That's like, I'll, you know, one day when I do have kids, they're definitely going to watch Mrs. Doubtfire and Jumanji, that's for sure. And I'll still watch them too.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that, and it's, I always figured that I would introduce those movies with happiness and joyfulness, and now there's a tinge of sadness where it's kind of like, you know, Well, what else has he been in? Like, what else has he done? Like, oh, well, you know.
Yeah, why?
Tragically, this is.
Yeah, it's like whatever happened. You show your kids these movies. It's like, well, what happened to him? And you're like, well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. Like, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and I think we're just using him as an example because that was another great actor we lost this year, is that it's just a generational thing where we just saw him in a different light. And, I mean, we did an entire podcast episode to him as well because these actors have such a huge impact. We get so involved in their work, and I think it extends beyond just people who love movies. When you see, I mean, we're really into them, so we've seen a lot more, we know a filmography, but the greats, they just reach out and touch everyone. So you don't need to, a lot of people may not have seen they may not have seen World's Greatest Dad, but they still know him from Dead Poets Society and Good Will Hunting. He was someone who because of the diversity of his body of work, you probably would have seen a Robin Williams film. Even if you're someone like, oh, I'm not in the demographic for Mrs. Doubtfire, but you are for something else because he had that diversity and had that range and he had the talent to appeal to people in more ways than one.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's such a painful loss. And it was something where I think I was holding back tears on this one. And I think that was just really something where I can understand people who are weeping openly. And again, this is for a person that, you know, you may not have met, that they still touch your lives. And I think that, quite honestly, that's the height of what an actor can do, of saying that I relate to you. You had such an influence and an impact in life, is that I feel like I've lost a friend or a family member, even though we've never met.
And that's something that's curious about the world we live in now, is that we're so, celebrity culture is so all-encompassing because of Twitter, because of Entertainment Tonight, because of the news programs. We're following along with like what all of these celebrities are doing. We're hearing them, and because they have Twitters, we feel like we're personally, like, they, we're seeing their thoughts unfiltered as a real person. So I think that by some measure, even if you don't pay attention to it, we feel closer to them. So those losses feel greater because we're seeing so much of them, as opposed to just, you know, I just see him in the movie and then that's it. Even someone like Christian Bale, who tries his hardest to stay out of the press and stuff, you're reading editorials about him, watching junket interviews, you know, it's kind of all encompassing. And so I think there's a familiarity there that makes these losses that much harder nowadays.
I mean, it certainly amplifies it, I will say that.
Yeah.
But it's just something where, I mean, it's almost been a week, and I still having, as people who have now been listening now, I'm still rambling, having trouble processing it. And I think that'll just keep being the case for a little while, because it's just something where you lose, I don't know, I feel like I lost the first guy I idolized among actors and celebrities.
Yeah, this one probably also hurts more just because, he was our childhood. We grew up with him. He was in my house, you know, almost every day, like I said. So that definitely makes it even tougher to cope with.
Right. And he never really left. That was the thing. It wasn't some childhood relic, like, oh, you know, he's great in kids' films, but he's still in kids' films now, and I don't watch those. I grew up, and he's in Insomnia. He's in One Hour Photo. He is now doing things that appeal to me as an adult. So I can't really leave him. You know, he's not someone that it's not nostalgia for him. That I feel like he just, there are films that I can appreciate from him as an adult, whereas films like Hook, which I haven't seen in forever, but people, as you guys can attest, it's not a great film, but you feel warmly towards him.
Yeah, and I still feel warmly towards the film, just because, and again, we grew up during the VCR era, the era of home video, and we were kind of one of the first generations to grow up rewatching things incessantly, and
like much Perry to the said, chagrin of our present,
yeah,
of our parents.
Yeah. Like, I could work
if you saw the list of things that I watched over and over as a kid, I...
Well, and it's, again, it's that familiarity, because I'm like you, Perry. Like, I probably watched Mrs. Doubtfire over 100 times. Same with Hook. Like, these movies that I would buy and I would watch them over and over again because I loved them so much. And so there was so much familiarity with Robin Williams, because those are such formative years for us when we're younger, you know, growing up like that. And like you said, Matt, it's not like we grew up and, you know, matured away from him. Kind of like I feel towards Adam Sandler. You know, I really enjoyed Happy Gilmore and, you know, Billy Madison, but I'm not still watching. I'm not looking forward to Bedtime Stories with, you know, with an adulterated glee. But Robin Williams was so versatile. He was doing so many different things, and he was going back and forth. It wasn't that he like left something completely behind. And I didn't even realize that he had even started, you know, before Hook and Aladdin and Mrs. Doubtfire. Before that were Dead Poets Society and Awakenings and The Fisher King, which he was already doing that dramatic stuff before, and he could switch gears so easily.
He was like hitting us from all sides too, because he was doing all that newer stuff that would appeal more so to us as we age, but at the same time his earlier stuff that appealed to us during our childhood years still has an appeal today. So I'm rewatching all that stuff now and watching his new stuff too, or at least some of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's something where I just feel guilty for all the negative feelings now, but it's something where, for instance, Mrs. Doubtfire 2, and I heard that's like,
what a terrible headline to have run.
What? That?
It's like, did we really need that, like, what, 2 days after it happened?
What, that it wasn't happening?
Yeah, or, it's just
that
like,
I was groaning about when it was announced, and I'm like, we don't need this. And I think part of it is just like, I want to see, I don't know. It just felt like something that was unnecessary. And it's just something where, and now I feel a little guilty now, because if he wanted to do it, maybe he, you know, made him happy or something. But that being said, I wouldn't have gone to see Mrs. Doubtfire 2, just like I wouldn't go see Night at the Museum 3 unless it was for my job.
I would have seen Mrs. Doubtfire 2.
I would have seen Mrs. Doubtfire 2. I would have seen it. No, if it was part, you would have to pay me to see it, which is, that's the thing. I would see it, but I wouldn't be looking forward to it.
Sure.
I'd be more looking forward to stuff where it was unpredictable. And I mean, stuff that I feel plays with his persona more. Like, Death to Smoochie is kind of ingenious. It doesn't work completely, but this notion of him being a kid's talk show, someone who, he plays a character designed to appeal to kids and yet has a very dark side to him, and then he just tries to sabotage and then murder someone who does genuinely feel that way. It's kind of it's an interesting dark comedy that I think has been overlooked. And that's the thing, there are films of his that I feel that there are films that have great acclaim, and then there are gems that I that I feel have maybe been missed, and I hope people seek out more and try to find.
He even made me like that as a kid a little. Like, because I knew him from all those earlier films, I was probably watching some of his other darker material earlier than I should have. So it's kind of like, you know, I grew up with him just in terms of my taste in films also. Like, he progressed at the perfect rate for me, I think. Well, actually, maybe a little too fast, because I don't think I should have been watching certain things.
Well, that's one of the things that's interesting when you're a kid, in terms of you find an actor you really like, and then you start following them to things that you're not really old enough to follow them to. So for me, like, I really like Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone. Hey, what's this movie, The Good Son?
I was watching, like, Witness at age 10. I was like, right. This will be good.
This will be good.
Another Peter Weir film. I enjoyed it, but
what a weird. That's another. That's Peter Weir, interesting director.
Maybe he's one of these directors like Linklater, who's quietly built up this amazing filmography. That just like, oh, he did do some really interesting good stuff.
Yeah, but you just keep forgetting he did it.
Yeah,
so
you're like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
I saw Deconstructing Harry when it was in theaters, and like, what was I? Maybe 11, 10 or 11. It's probably not the best idea ever.
Not appropriate. But that's how you know it's a good idea. It's like, I'll follow you to anything,
yeah,
whether
pretty
I'm
much.
Ready for, whether the, I'm ready for it or not. And then, thankfully, you come back to it as an adult. Like, oh, now I get it. And now I appreciate it more. So, It's not just the voice of Genie is acting really weird. I don't understand. Why is he sad?
I have that song in my head now, though, because I'm sure you guys saw Never Had a Friend Like Me.
Okay.
Because I was watching them do the tribute performance on the YouTube clip from the Broadway show, and like ever since, I just can't get it out of my head.
Yeah, that's. I forgot that there is a Broadway show underway.
I don't know if my love of Robin Williams is going to make me see that, though.
My love of Robin Williams is going to make me want to see more Robin Williams things. I mean, I'll rewatch Aladdin, but I'm not going to go see things based off Aladdin. I hope that maybe I will finally see Popeye. I definitely need to see World According to Garp.
There's one I haven't seen that I should.
Yeah. So there's still all these blind spots in a rich filmography that I wish had continued on for much longer. So rest in peace, Robin Williams. We miss you greatly. I don't know if you guys have anything else to say about him, because I feel we could go on just commiserating about this for quite some time.
Let's talk about movies of his we want our
recommend.
Yeah, I like that idea.
I think that's a fantastic idea, Adam. What do you got for us?
I am recommending The Fisher King. It was very, very tough for me to rewatch. Like I said, I couldn't even fathom watching another Robin Williams movie so shortly after, but it had been a while since I had seen The Fisher King, so I dove back into it a couple days ago, and it's just tremendous. If you're unaware, came out in 1991, directed by Terry Gilliam. It's one of his, I think it's one of his best films.
I agree.
Jeff Bridges is the lead, and he plays a radio shock jock, so a kind of a Howard Stern type. And this was in the early 90s of the beginning of kind of the post. It was the middle of the Wall Street, you know, yuppie excess, stuff like that. And so the film opens, and he's a shock jock, and he has a listener call in, and sounds like a socially awkward listener, and he's talking about how he went to a restaurant and found this beautiful woman that he loved, and Jeff Bridges' character says, you're never going to get her. She's a yuppie. They're all yuppie scum. We need to wipe them off the face of the planet. These yuppie, terrible people, you know, that are invading our restaurants here in New York City. And Jeff Bridges' character is very self-centered and very self-involved, and turns out this listener that the next day, or I think the same night, takes a shotgun into that restaurant and goes on a mass killing spree, and thus kind of throwing a wrench into Jeff Bridges' character's career. And so then this is the prologue of the film. It fast forwards 3 years later, and Jeff Bridges' character is living with his girlfriend, who owns a video store, living above her video store. You can tell he's suffering greatly still from the trauma of what happened, what he caused to happen, what he feels responsible for happening, suffering a little bit of agoraphobia. And one night, while he's out down by the river contemplating suicide himself, runs across a homeless man played by Robin Williams, who saves him from a couple of kids who were planning on dousing him in gasoline and lighting him on fire. And so he strikes up a bit of a friendship with Robin Williams' character, and plans to just kind of skirt out as quickly as possible until he realizes or discovers that Robin Williams' character suffered a mental breakdown after his wife was shot in front of him at this same restaurant that the murderer went through. And so so Jeff Bridges takes it upon himself. He feels like he can fix himself if he can fix Perry, who is Robin Williams' character. So they strike up this friendship, and he sets about kind of rehabilitating Perry, but it refuses to delve into sentimentality, and it kind of embraces the mental illness and the depression aspects of the characters. It doesn't get into sap territory, I think largely probably because of Terry Gilliam. And Robin Williams is fantastic in this movie, because it's a wonderful role to display his talents, because his comedic sensibilities can shine when he's playing the kind of triumphant Perry who feels like he's living out kind of a fantasy, searching for the Fisher King, looking for the Holy Grail, and he's very funny then. But then you can see when his kind of psychotic breaks start to happen, he starts to remember the trauma. It gets very, very dramatic and very tough, and those scenes are really kind of tough to watch now in retrospect, but the interplay between he and Jeff Bridges is fantastic, and I really wish they could have worked together again now recently, because they're just so great together. The woman who plays Jeff Bridges' girlfriend, Mercedes Rule, actually won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress in the film. And I had completely forgotten, but Michael Jeter has a wonderful supporting performance in this movie. He's so great, and that's another one that we lost too soon. He's fantastic. And The Fisher King is, it's really funny. It's also sad. It's also dramatic, but it's ultimately uplifting, but not in a saccharine sort of way. If you haven't seen it, it's on Netflix Instant Watch now. So it's available there. I was kind of dreading watching it again, and it is a little tough to watch, but it's really just a wonderful performance of Williams that kind of displays his whole range of talents. And I was surprised to find a lot of people I talked to hadn't seen it before. It's one that I guess kind of slipped through the cracks, but it's one that I would highly recommend seeking out if you haven't seen it, and even if you have seen it, to watch again.
It's on Netflix. You can watch it now.
Yeah.
So... yeah, I agree. Perry, what about you?
I am definitely going for Mrs. Doubtfire. There is, like, that is my favorite Robin Williams movie of all time. I mean, like I said, that movie played in my VHS player every single night for a good stretch of time. And it was kind of like having Mrs. Doubtfire in my life. Like, I would look at that character and I would think, why can't she be my nanny? But, like, I had a nanny when I was a kid. I still love her to death, but... that was something that I wanted in my life. It would just make me feel good. And in case you have never seen Mrs. Doubtfire, well, first of all, go watch it yourself. Share it with your kids. Share it with older people, too, in your life. Even if you don't think it's going to appeal to them, it will, because it's not just a comedy. It's a drama, too. And it makes this kind of high concept feel so grounded and real. And you can really connect to all the characters. And that's kind of what makes it so special to me and lets me still watch it and appreciate it the same way I did when I was younger, too. But he stars in it as a guy who got divorced, and his wife kicks him out of their house. So he wants to be with his kids. So in order to spend more time with them again, he answers his wife's ad to have a nanny come and look after them. And he dresses up as Mrs. Doubtfire and goes to work. And he cleans, he tries to cook, and he does all these crazy things. There's just so many moments in this. Like, I couldn't even pick a favorite. If I had to right now, just because it's fresh in my mind, because I'm looking at the IMDb page, and if you look at the IMDb page, the trailer clip, the clip that you look at when it's paused, is the face when he has all the cream on his face, when that monitor woman walks in and he shoves his face in it and pops up and says, hello. I just love that part. And when he pegs Pierce Brosnan in the head with a piece of fruit, the cooking scene too, when he leans over into the pots and he lights on fire. There's just so many moments in that movie that I'll never forget. And I think it's also I think it's actually a really well written movie, and it's pretty well shot too. But that movie would never have been what it is if not for Robin Williams. Nobody can play that character quite like that, where there's so many moments in that movie. I don't realize this as much when I was younger, but now I could see it, where the character breaks and you could see Daniel in Mrs. Doubtfire, and it comes at just like the perfect moments. Like, for example, that cooking scene, while he's cooking, no one's watching and the kids aren't in the room, so he's not in full Mrs. Doubtfire mode, but in the hysteria of that moment when he's making these mistakes and like it's boiling over and he's lit on fire, all of a sudden he says just one line in her voice, and it's like that kind of feels so honest and real. And it happens towards the tail end of the film too, when he goes to rescue the guy from choking. I don't want to spoil anything, I guess, in case someone hasn't seen it. But it's kind of like half Mrs. Doubtfire, half Daniel, and it feels right for that reason. And, I mean, the whole movie feels right for that reason. And, you know, part of the reason I didn't want a Mrs. Doubtfire, too, is because of where this movie ends. It's just such a great finale to that character. Like, he just hangs up the mask and the suit and he gets this job that is just so perfect for him that he earns. And, you know, it's not like what we get nowadays where one of these comedies has like a nice little bow on top. It's something that feels real and right, but maybe not perfect. And that's always stuck with me. This is probably one of the most special movies in my life, and I will never stop carrying this one with me.
All right, thank you. Mrs. Doubtfire, also one that sticks with the childhood. But yeah, it's both of those are fantastic films. My selection is World's Greatest Dad. The reason I chose that one is because I think for me, before it came out, I think I was starting to just, Robin Williams just wasn't surprising me anymore. And World's Greatest Dad, if you look at it on the surface, it's like, okay, Robin Williams in a film from Bobcat Goldthwait, co-starring Daryl Sebera, who is from frickin' Spy Kids, what? And instead, you get this incredibly powerful, dark comedy. In the film, Robin Williams plays a high school poetry teacher slash frustrated writer. And Daryl Sebera plays his kid, who is one of the worst human beings imaginable. His kid is a monster. He is rude, self-centered, a perverted sociopath, pretty much. And everyone hates him. No one likes this kid at all. And you even feel that Robin Williams' character reluctantly likes him, but only because he's his father. But then when his son dies by autoerotic asphyxiation. So his son hangs himself accidentally. And it's a heart-wrenching moment. And yet it inspires William's character to write a suicide note. And that suicide note then becomes a hit that makes everyone reevaluate the dead son as someone who wasn't this little monster, but now on the basis of this pretty lie, this thing that isn't real, now the son is a hero and he's suffering, and everyone just started making up this own narrative. And this role is so perfect for Williams in that I feel it combines some of the best work that he had done previously. It's very funny. There's some very powerful dramatic moments, like when he discovers his son's body. And then there is just the dark, disturbing aspects of it that you would have seen in his other films. And it just all comes together perfectly. I think it's a wonderful performance in a film that would never be recognized by the Academy, because it's just not that kind of film in any way, shape, or form. And yet it is such a amazing film. And one of the things I absolutely love about it is the message of, it's better to be honest, no matter how ugly that honesty may be, rather than telling a pretty lie. And I think, for me, that message has made it easier to discuss the films of Robin Williams that I didn't like, because when you see that he gave such an amazing performance in a film that's about honesty, and I think that honesty is what carries over to other performances of his, where he's willing to show that there is pain underneath that should be acknowledged, and that when you acknowledge it, it can be so freeing and liberating. And so World's Greatest Dad is a fantastic film. It's one you don't expect, and I can't recommend it highly enough. And yet there's so many other films that I'm sure we could have easily recommended today. Those are just three. So World's Greatest Dad is on Netflix. You can check it out there. And you should just check out all these films and so many more from his career. So thank you for listening. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Perry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you guys for having me.
Oh, it was our pleasure. Where can we find you on Twitter?
You can get me at P. Nemiroff.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.